Hi, everybody. The George Wilder Jr. Show is now on. Hi, everybody. The George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air.
This is what I call freedom. Well, I want to say, I want to tell you, I want to say, when you can do what you want to do and go where you want to go and leave where you want to leave and love who you want to love and be what you want to be. Join what you want to join.
This is Chicago's finest internet radio show, making a world a better place, one show at a time. The George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air. Take it away, Dad.
All right, well, here we go. Welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show. Almost caught me a little bit off guard, but this is the George Wilder Jr. Show. All right, welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show. All of you all around the world, it is such a beautiful day. I mean, I just can't. Some of you are probably tired of me talking about how it's so nice and global. And if you live in Illinois, then you know. You really know. But if you don't live in Illinois, wherever you are in the world, I hope you're having some great, great weather. And I hope you're not depressed and feeling down and feeling lonely and feeling, you know, you're not worthy and all that kind of thing. No. This is George Wilder Jr. of the George Wilder Jr. Show. Tuning in, on the air to try to lift your spirits a little bit. All right. That's what we're going to do. Try to do. I can't promise anything because, you know, I'm just me. All right. My guest today on this on the show today is Dewey Reynolds. I guess he's going to be talking about two shades of vice and commentary. I hope that's clean. You know, so I'm thinking of shades of gray or something like that. And he's going to be here to talk about two shades of vice. Hopefully it's nothing erotic. All right. This show is not about erotica, but I'm pretty sure it's not. I'm pretty sure it's going to be pretty clean. It better be. Anyway, welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show, broadcasting live from the city of Chicago, out of the state of Illinois, and we have a budget, people. We have a budget in the state of Illinois, and the governor doesn't like it. He can't stand it. He wished this state was, fell off the cliff. And you know what? If this state had fell off the cliff, he would have just blamed a lot of other people. He's the governor of Illinois. He refused to sign a budget for 2.5 years in order for this state not to fall off the cliff. The General Assembly, the legislators in the General Assembly, led by Democrats, had to take over. We could not let this Republican governor destroy this wonderful state, this beautiful state, because he has a problem with people working and going to a doctor and, you know, getting paid and having a job. You know, he doesn't like that. Of course, you know, he's a Republican. But anyway, the Democrats stepped in and now we have a budget in the state of Illinois. Because if you've been listening to the show for the last, I'm going to say the last 2.5 years, I've been in his ass about not doing his job, because the state of Illinois, we have a constitution. And a constitution says, like every state has a constitution. And that constitution, one of the primary requirements of the state constitution is that the governor signs a budget into place every fiscal year, which is July 1st in the city of Chicago and in the state of Illinois. And the guy refused to do it. He was holding that state hostage. We were being held hostage. In order for him to sign a budget, in order for him to sign a budget, he had this thing called his turnaround agenda. He wanted to bust unions. He wanted power to do things that was detrimental to the state of Illinois. And Democrats said no. So Rauner said, "Well, I'm not going to sign a budget. I don't care about nothing. I don't care about the people. I'm rich. So not having a budget in the state of Illinois is not going to hurt me, because I'm a billionaire and you people ain't got nothing." So, you know, it's the classic Republican holding people, children, the disabled, the elderly hostage, not signing a budget to try and get what he wants for the state. And what he wanted for the state was to, you know, destroy it. Either way, he wanted to take it down. But the Democrats said, well, and the people said, well, if this guy is not going to do his job, we're going to have to do it for him. And that's what we did. We did it for him. We weren't about to let Illinois go into a third year without a budget, because that would have been totally, totally detrimental. Street projects would have stopped. Street construction would have stopped. The lottery would have left and never came back. You know, people would have lost their jobs because they wouldn't be able to get paid. And schools are still in the flux, so they're trying to straighten that out. Already, Rauner is saying that he's going to veto any kind of school funding if it's towards pensions and things like that. And I'll say to the General Assembly in the state of Illinois, override his ass again. If he's not doing his job, it's up to the people of Illinois, the voters of Illinois, and those who care about Illinois to get things done. Same thing with Donald Trump and the Republicans in Congress. If these guys are not doing their jobs, folks, it's up to us to do their job for them. And when it's time for re-election, we vote asses right out to the curb, you know. So a lot of people really don't need to get upset. I mean, we just got a few more months or so, another year, actually. And we can vote these scoundrels out of office, you know. But anyways, the state of Illinois has a budget. It's not a perfect budget. It's not. There's still more work to do. There's no doubt about that. But at least there we have a starting point. There's a point where we can start rebuilding and try to undo the damage that Rauner has caused to the state by not signing a budget for 2.5 years. Because when you don't have a budget in the state of Illinois, at least I'm assuming in every state, there's no way you can spend money. Money will not be spent. Everything, I mean, even state workers, they're not supposed to get paid. It's in the Constitution. So by Democrats stepping up to the plate, finally, they should have done it 2 years ago, but finally, it's a good thing. And Rauner, this Republican governor, Bruce Rauner, believe me, folks, he does not like it. I mean, he was yelling and bitching, and he fired everybody on his staff, just about everybody. And these people had nothing whatsoever to do with the override of his veto of not wanting to have a budget for the state of Illinois. He went around firing innocent people, good people, talented people, because he lost. Okay, he just threw a tantrum and just started firing people. People who have done absolutely nothing, people who were doing their jobs. And this is what Republicans do. They scapegoat people, blaming people for things that have happened that was not their fault. That is not their fault. And that's what happened. This guy just fired everybody. And people were saying, well, he's firing so many people, he's not going to have a government. And this is going to make it pretty hard for him to win in November if he doesn't have a solid staff behind him. But I'm pretty sure Bruce Rauner is meeting with his goons, and they're going to try to come up with some strategy to try to win in November 2018. He's coming up with something, you know. I mean, you don't see Bruce Rauner a lot. He's not around a lot. So whenever he's not around and you don't see him, I mean, other governors were really they were out there. I mean, saw him almost every day. It was all on television. They were out and about around the state, including Chicago. They were all over the place, but not Bruce Rauner. He only comes out when he has something to say. And then he goes back in hiding. I mean, he's a governor that comes out and says what he has to say. Don't ask him no questions. Get out of his way. He said what he said. Now he's gone. He's it's my way or the highway type of a governor. You know, he doesn't too much answer. He doesn't do interviews most of the time. He doesn't do interviews. He doesn't answer. He doesn't give question and answer sessions to the press like previous governors have in the city of Chicago. This guy is just, you know, he thinks he knows it all. He's like Trump. He thinks he's the smartest person in the room, and he's not. Because if he was the smartest person in the room, he would have some legislative accomplishments. He has none. He has no legislative accomplishments. None. This is why he's going around firing people. Firing good people, people who had nothing whatsoever to do with the debacle that he witnessed a few weeks ago with this veto. So we have a budget in the state of Illinois, and that is so great. And we have a budget in the state of Illinois, and a lot of us we're happy about it, because now the comptroller can start sending out checks, money owed to a lot of these agencies that weren't getting it, and they were about to close their doors. And there's a lot of agencies in the city of Chicago, social programs and all this stuff, they have shut completely down. It's going to take years to get these programs up and going again. And because Bruce Rauner, next year, we have to have another budget. And next year, a fiscal year is coming up, July 1st, and there's going to be a budget that's going to be have to be signed. And I'm pretty sure Rauner is going to veto it. And if he does veto it, if he does veto a budget for 2018, he's cementing his loss. He's cementing his election loss for 2018. There's no doubt about that. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. Follow me on Facebook. Follow me on Block Talk Radio. Follow me all over the place. I am here, folks. The George Wilder Jr. Show is on the air. If you would like your product, service, or your book to be mentioned on the George Wilder Jr. Show twice a day, 4 days a week, right here on the George Wilder Jr. Show, just email the show or email its host for more details. Thank you.
And we're back now with the roundtable, and I have a feeling you guys are going to have a little different comments than Tom Bossert had about that GIF. Let's look at it again. This happened just as we were ending our other roundtable.
All right.
Okay, Anna, I got to start with you.
I'm a CNN commentator. I think that is unacceptable. I think that is the
Republican
president of the United
CNN
States taking
commentator.
Things way too far. It is an incitement to violence. He is going to get somebody killed in the media. Maybe that will stop him. I am disappointed beyond belief by the answer that the Homeland Security advisor just gave. What a wuss. What a wuss. You could see that he is ceding his principles. You are the Homeland Security advisor, and you can't stand here and say the difference between right and wrong. That's what's part of the problem. He is surrounded by enablers that do nothing but shake their heads and nod their heads in agreement with everything that he says. They have got to stop. They have got to stand for democracy, for freedom of the press. This
exactly.
is just going
stand
way
for something.
Too far. The president of the United States is inciting violence against the free press. And America, we cannot stand for it.
I mean, it is just kind of theater of the absurd, right? I don't think any of us would have thought that this is something that the president, any president, would do. But in particular, it just comes, as you mentioned, right after the shooting of Steve Scalise. Republicans and Democrats said it's time to take the rhetoric down a notch, and this clearly does not do that.
And everyone that we spoke to on the Hill right after that incident said the president was actually quite good on that stage. He was reassuring. He called for the country to get together. He gave a really good speech and visited the hospital to see Steve Scalise. And now this, listen, I know a lot of people who work for CNN who have to be scared and wondering why the president has decided to physically pummel somebody with the CNN logo on his face. So it'd be interesting to get some reaction.
Nobody at CNN is scared. If anything, this is making each and every one of us more resolute not to cower at the bullying of this president. This is a free press, this is a free country, this is a democracy. And if he thinks that with these little tricks he's going to scare Jeff Zucker, he's going to scare anybody at CNN, he's got something different coming. We are resolute at continuing searching the truth, speaking the truth, and calling out right versus wrong.
And I'm sitting here thinking now, what do Americans think when they look at that? What do those voters think who I talk to in Ohio? I know that when we talk about ourselves and we say, oh, it's terrible that he's going after the media, but that's pummeling somebody from CNN?
Well, I think that my guess is the president doesn't regard this as literally inciting people to violence.
I'm sure he thinks it's funny.
And I think that most people see it and they think pro wrestling is fake. Yeah. And they think that's sort of what he's getting at here. The problem is that it's more juvenile behavior. It's something that most people, including a lot of his own supporters, want him to quit doing, and he can't do it. You know, I didn't agree with the way Thomas Bossert was talking about this, but I think he's right that it is genuine in the sense that he is showing us genuinely who the president
is. This is not funny. Look, there's way too many.
I didn't
many,
say it was.
I know, but I mean, there's way too, and he can't think it's funny. There's way too many unstable people out in the streets right now at this time of impassioned and heightened passions. We all know it. We've all seen it. We have seen the results of harassment. We've seen the results of shootings. We've seen the result of violence out in the street. And for the president of the United States, who is supposed to be unifying this country on a July 4th, weekend to be tweeting out
Trump
incitement to violence. It is incitement to violence. Let us not parse words. Let us not call it by any other name. It is disgusting by this president. Yet one more disgusting act.
All right, the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, this is a stunner, folks. They're now saying that 32 million people, 32 million Americans would lose health care under the GOP plan. And everybody keeps saying that this health care bill it has failed, is dead. It is not dead. I said this yesterday on the show. It is not dead. As long as this healthcare bill, it can fail a thousand times. This healthcare bill, it can fail a thousand times. But as long as it is in the hands of the Republicans, they can always bring it up anytime for a vote. Anytime, they can bring it up every single day if they wanted to. And it could fail every single day, but they can still bring it up because it's in their hands. They control Congress, and they are adamant about getting rid of Obamacare and changing it around to Trump care. Trump care, that there is no doubt about it. Everybody who's anybody is going to be thrown off their health care. I don't understand this. Why do these people get elected and go to Congress and hurt people? These people were not, and I'm talking about politicians in Congress, the representatives and the senators, they're all Republicans. They control everything. And all these people are sitting around trying to figure out is how many people to throw off their health care. It's like these people went to Congress, were voted in to hurt people, even their own constituency, even their own voters. They don't care. And these Republicans, they're only in office a short time. Okay, the representatives, they have to, most of them are going to run again because they only do 2 years. And I believe the senators, I think they do at least 4-6 years. They're only in office for a short time. And most of these guys want to keep their jobs. Most of these guys and girls, they want to keep their jobs, but they're not going to keep their jobs. Not like this. You're killing the people who put your butt in office. That doesn't make sense. And you want to keep your job? You think we're going to be stupid enough after you vote to throw so many people off health care? You think we're going to re-elect you? Are you nuts? Are you nuts? President Trump, I hate to say president, it just comes out sometimes and sometimes it doesn't. He had a meeting today with a lot of these senators who oppose appealing and replacing Obamacare. And now Trump, I mean, they say that Trump jumped on him. He chastised him. And I don't think that's going to work because the people of this country, of America, they don't want this atrocious bill. And it's nothing Donald Trump can say. He can, be as upset as he wants to be. But the people run this country, not the Republicans in Congress and not Donald Trump. It's a shame that this man has so much power, but he does. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio, folks. All right, let's see what we have. All right, you're on the George Wilder Jr. Show. Go right ahead.
This is Dewey Reynolds, your guest for today.
Yeah, I know that. You're on the marquee here. You're going to be, is this a book, Two Shades of Vice?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so give us a little bit of your bio and all that good stuff.
Okay, my name is Dewey Reynolds. I'm an author, screenwriter, short filmmaker, computer expert. I live in Kansas City, Missouri. I was born in Kansas City in 1964. And I decided to become a writer after high school, after writing short stories and poetry and such. And my latest book is entitled Two Shades of Vice, based on the true story of an interracial couple's life together in crime. And it details a story about my interracial parents' life of crime during the 1960s here in Kansas City. As far as like my hobbies, I love to read, I love to write, I love to travel, love to cycle, love to roller skate, and just love to research and just be adventurous.
Sound like a true American.
Yes, sir.
All right. Okay. Two Shades of Gray. All right. What made you want to write this book? It's fiction, I understand.
No, it's nonfiction.
Oh, it's nonfiction. Okay, pardon me.
Yeah, yes, it is nonfiction. Well, what prompted me to write the story was I was over at the Division of Family Services here in Kansas City getting some documentation about my stay, my 15-year stay in one particular foster home. And in one of the reports, it said that both of my parents were known criminals. They were someone who had a lengthy criminal record. So I went over to the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. I started doing research into the criminal background, and they came up with a lot of information about my mother and my father and about their whole criminal background. And I was able to obtain police reports and criminal rap sheets, and also through eyewitness accounts from people that was there on the streets at the time along with them. And so I felt like I had enough information. I was armed with enough material to write a full-length, you know, true crime nonfiction story about my parents' life together in crime here in Kansas City during the 1960s. So it was really interesting and to know that they were an interracial couple that were involved with one another. Also, they were involved heavily in crime. So I thought it would really make a great story.
You know what? I think I want to read it already. I mean,
oh, yeah. It's a powerful story with some strong content in it.
Yeah, I think it's a powerful story. You make it sound like it's powerful. And the first thing I came to mind was Bonnie and Clyde, but I know that's kind of far-fetched.
Yeah, I would say, George, is far-fetched because Bonnie and Clyde were like bank robbers who killed people. Now, my father may have been involved in a murder or two, but my mother was never involved. But they basically, their facet of crime was He had bought a house that was solely used for the purpose of vice, and it was a body house, and this very body house is mentioned in a lot of those police reports that I received from the police department that talked about how they sold drugs, they sold bootleg whiskey, they sold beer, they sold contraband cigarettes, they sold even food items like frozen meats because my father was a hijacker too, for some of them Italian gangsters in Kansas City. He would hijack trucks along with some of their other thugs, and they would hijack beer trucks and whiskey trucks and trucks carrying other commodities. So, yeah, it was, but his thing was he put her in charge of prostitution. So a lot of the women who worked for my father on the streets would bring the tricks to the body house, and my mother would be there to greet them and collect the money, take them upstairs to the room, and they had a little rendezvous, and you know, and she would, you know, kind of like buffer them and, you know, just tell them thank you. And, you know, we're always here. If you want a good time, this is the place to come. And at a time when other prostitutes were taking their johns or their tricks to like seedy motels and other places, my father had a house set up where the women that worked the street for him would bring those guys to the house.
How did you feel when you first learned of this, that your mother and father were into
It was a euphoric feeling. You know, I felt a certain euphoria because of the simple fact that, like I said, I was placed in foster care at 6 months. So I never really did. I met my father, I think I was 13 for the first time a month before he died. I only met him one time. I met my mother, and I forged a great relationship with her. But to know that they were involved in all this and to know that they had rap sheets, these criminal rap sheets, because what really blew me away, I'll tell you the biggest thing that blew me away, especially about my father, he did prison time in 5 different states. So that told me this guy really got around. He really made his rounds.
Wow. This is a compelling. This is really compelling. And
it really is. It's a very, very compelling story.
It is. It is. And I guess when you first learned of it, you weren't that surprised because you were placed in foster care. You didn't really know them.
Right. But, well, that's where it struck my curiosity. Like, why did myself, my brother, my sister end up in foster care in the first place? And I would eventually get my answer because of the fact that my mother and father were criminals on the run. They were running from the law. And they had no stability. They couldn't. I mean, I'm not making excuses for them, but they had no true stability, or they couldn't provide like a stable home for us. So they just dropped us off, and they never came back.
Wow, that has to hurt, kind of, when you found that out.
It hurts deep. I mean, as they say, the old timers used to say, it cuts deep, and. It's a deep wound. Would feel like it's been throwing salt on the wounds over the years, but I think I've gotten better with dealing with it and everything, especially into my adulthood and learn how to forgive and just move on.
Yeah, you have to. You have to leave the past in the past, even though the past has really been devastating. You have to try to leave it in the past because the future is calling you. You know,
absolutely. And, I like the way you put that.
It's true, though. I mean, you have to put it behind you and go forward. You know it's there. You'll never forget it. You know it's there as a part of your life, but you know you can't let it stop you. You know, so
there you go. You're right about that.
It's very compelling. You know.
Yeah.
And how is the book doing so far?
Well, it's doing okay. I mean, it's getting sales slowly but surely. Yeah, it's gaining a little traction. Not as well as, you know, as I wanted to, but I believe it will over time.
Yeah, I think it will, too, because you're on the show, and I'm going to help you promote it and get it out there, because I think this is a compelling story that people should read. And I want to say this. You're probably not the only one who has experienced something like this. So a lot of people probably can, you know, relate to this, what you say in the book.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I would say so. I'm thinking there's other people that may have had similar experiences. But I think what makes the story unique itself is, like I said, you know, you have this interracial couple during the early 1960s, like a white man and a black woman who are involved with one another, who are pretty much romantically tied to one another, but also they're partners in crime together. They're doing all this crime together. And it was something that was really unheard of during that time. I mean, it was bad enough. The way society saw it, the way the lawmakers or whoever these people saw it, as though, you know, they were against the interracial thing, and you had the anti-miscegenation laws that outlawed it, really, where they didn't allow interracial to like cohabitate or become sexually involved or to be married or any of those things. So they kind of like went against the grain. They really did. They set their own rules and they did their own thing.
Yeah, they did their own thing, all right. And this is Tokyo. Yes, this sounds like a movie, man.
You know what? You're only, I'll be honest with you, George, you are the only, you're only the 100th person I didn't hear. They're like, oh, movie. Yeah, because I think the story, is, like I said, within itself is so unique. It's so original. Yeah. And when I first found out about it, matter of fact, I'll tell you this much. There was a police captain that was standing next to the lady who works at the police department at the headquarters downtown, who saw those police mug shots of my mother and father, and he was looking at the records. And I think I overheard him tell us, he said, I've been on the force like almost 30 years. I've never heard of nothing like this before, about an interracial couple. here in Kansas City or even abroad, anywhere else in the United States, that were doing these type of things together. I mean, I've heard of maybe white couples, even black couples doing it. I've never heard of an interracial couple during that time period who were doing the things that they were doing.
Yeah, I agree with him. I never heard of it either. That is why I say, hey, wow. It's like it's been just swept under the rug or something. But right. I'm pretty sure
Like I said, I didn't. But the funny thing is, George, I didn't know this for the first 20, 25 years of my life until I decided to start doing research. And when that one record told me from the Division of Family Services that they were known convicted felons, they were known criminals, that's why I said, well, I got to stretch this thing a little further, and I want to find out deeper more about the crimes and what they did as far as their criminal lifestyle.
All right. Do you have the book with you?
Yes, I do. I have the book with me. I sure do.
Can you read us an excerpt?
I sure can. Let me see. I'm gonna try to find something interesting to read for you, George. Listeners.
All right, Dewey Reynolds on the George Wilder Jr. Show. He's gonna be giving us an excerpt of Two Shades of Vice.
Okay. Let me see. Give me a second here. But the book is like 360 pages.
I was going to say, I like the title. I think the title is great. Two Shades of Vice.
Yeah, I figure since you have this white guy and you have this black woman that's involved in crime again, they both are involved in vice. So I decided that a title like Two Shades of Vice would really be, you know, a really good title for that.
Yeah, it's an eye catcher. I mean, it'll make you, if you've seen this book, this title, this on this book, among other books, it will make you kind of just, hey, let me check this one out.
Yes, absolutely. Like I said, bear with me a second here.
I probably
should have already done this. I'm trying to, because I feel like there's so much good material and there's so many good chapters. And I know people love gangster and mafia.
Because
truly, my father was involved with some of the vice lords here in Kansas, some of the heavy hitters as far as like the mafia, organized crime, or the well-known gangsters. Because of him being the criminal on the level that he was, I mean, he forged ties with those people. So let me see here. Let's see. Give me a second here. Cocked his leg.
Do you have an agent?
No, I'm kind of like on my own, really.
Okay.
You know, I got just, a good extra.
Okay. All right.
Now, go ahead. What were you going to say, George?
I was going to say maybe you should look for an agent, someone who can actually push your book to the movie studios.
You know, that would be nice. That really would, because like I said, it's a well-written book. It really is well-edited, well-written. Yeah. It has a photo gallery in there for, you know, and even some actual police reports to kind of like make the story more tangible. And I think it's something that, that like I say, it's something I believe that transcends across many different lines as far as racial, gender, you know, all kinds of background. Okay, I got an excerpt for you here, George.
All right.
It says, okay, here we go. This is kind of like a gangster element or some of the mafia guys my father was involved with. Okay, it says, because my father's name was Gordon Reynolds. Okay, it says, Camisano snapped his finger. He pointed to Gordon, Catalano, Cusimano, and Blando. All four men made their way further into a darker area of the warehouse basement. They returned with two wooden bats and brass knuckles. Gordon and Catalano wasted no time swinging the bats at the men's chests and stomachs. The impact of the solid wood quickly bruised their internal organs. One hard swing after another had both victims coughing up blood. Their shirts were quickly stained with large blood rings. Gordon and Catalano kept swinging with brute force. Two ribs on Jerry's lower abdomen cracked audibly. Cusimano and Blando came behind the men swinging the bats and pounded the faces of Jerry and Lenny with the brass knuckles. After several blows, the men's skin was broken with much blood streaming down their faces and necks and onto their shirts and pants. Their eyes were almost completely swollen shut by that point. A few of Lenny's teeth had fallen out after being shattered by the hard steel of the brass knuckles. Their punishment was harsh, brutal, in every sense of the word. Camisano wanted them beaten within inches of their lives, but not totally left for dead. Once again, Camisano had proved that he was a hoodlum's hoodlum, a vicious criminal intent on destroying anyone who got in his way.
Wow, that's compelling. That was, I mean, you get right to the action there. You get right to the heart of the story, probably. And yeah. Where can we find the book if we wanted to, you know, get a hold of the book, you know, read the book, okay, or, you know, buy the book, purchase the book? Where can we do that?
Okay, well, you can go one way. You can go to my website, which is www.DeweyReynoldsBooks.com. That's www.DeweyReynoldsBooks.com. That's DeweyReynoldsBooks.com. Or you can go to Amazon.com and go to the book section and pull up Two Shades of Vice, and you can order it either in print edition or either ebook edition.
Kindle.
Yes, on Amazon Kindle. Wow. Or you can order a print edition. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is this your first book?
No, I've written other stories too. Yes, I've done other stories that I've kind of played around with. But I will say this much. This is actually my first nonfiction true crime book.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Which
okay.
just happened so to be about my parents. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They are interesting. They are some interesting parents. And I want to thank you for being on the show, and I wish you a lot of luck with your book.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I really do.
No problem. We're going to try and I'm trying to push your book. I'm going to try to push this show. And if you want to, you know, if you have a website and you want to a link to this show that you're on, you can I can email it to you.
I would appreciate that greatly, Jordan. Yeah. I do appreciate you having me on, and I'm going to try to build up, like, you know, some like media section on my website. So interviews I may do in the future, I can just add that to my website, and hopefully people can listen and they can really, really understand, you know, about the book and about me too.
Yeah. You can also add this show, this link to your website. People come and, you know, your fans come, they click on it, they hear you on the show. All right. Yeah. Thanks for being on the show, man. You were great. And I wish you a lot of luck with the book. All right.
Thank you very much, George. And take care. Thank you.
Two Shades of Vice, I mean. All right, bye-bye.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, Dewey Reynolds on the George Wilder Jr. Show. His book, Two Shades of Vice. Not Two Shades of Gray, Two Shades of Vice. All right, that was interesting. We will be right back, folks.
When I first saw the tweet this morning, I was frankly disgusted. I thought to myself, this dude has got such a fixation with women and blood. What is wrong with him? And then you remember that this dude, this disgusting dude, is the president of the United States. And you realize just how much he is diminishing the presidency of the United States. You realize that what he is doing is not just acting for Donald Trump. He's acting for all of us. He's acting for our president. And he is
And we're back now with the roundtable. And I have a feeling you guys are going to have a little different comments than Tom Bossert had about that, Jim.
Welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show, broadcasting live out of Chicago. And we are helping to make the world a better place, one show at a time. Thank you for listening. Thank you for finding the show, downloading the show, and just having a great time. Here we go.
Ashley Judd, stupid fucking slut. You can't sue someone for calling them a cunt. If you can't handle the internet, fuck off, whore. I wish Ashley Judd would die a horrible death. She is the absolute worst. Ashley Judd, you're the reason women shouldn't vote. Twisted is such a bad movie, I don't even want to rape it. Whatever you do, don't tell Ashley Judd. She'll die alone with a dried out vagina. If I had to fuck an older woman, oh my God, I would fuck the shit out of Ashley Judd. That bitch is hot AF. The unforgivable shit I would do to her. Online misogyny is a global gender rights tragedy, and it is imperative that it ends. Girls' and women's voices and our allies' voices are constrained in ways that are personally, economically, professionally, and politically damaged. And when we curb abuse, we will expand freedom. I am a Kentucky basketball fan, so on a fine March day last year, I was doing one of the things I do best. I was cheering for my Wildcats. The daffodils were blooming, but the referees were not blowing the whistle when I was telling them to. Funny, they're very friendly to me before the opening tip, but they really ignore me during the game. Three of my players were bleeding, so I did the next best thing. I tweeted. It is routine for me to be treated in the ways I've already described to you. It happens to me every single day on social media platforms such as Twitter and Facebook. Since I joined Twitter in 2011, misogyny and misogynists have amply demonstrated they will dog my every step. My spirituality, my faith, being a hillbilly, I can say that, you can't, all of it is fair game. And I have responded to this with various strategies. I've tried engaging people. This one guy was sending me hyper-sexual, nasty stuff, and there was a girl in his avatar, and I wrote him back and said, "Is that your daughter? I feel a lot of fear that you may think about and talk to women this way." And he surprised me by saying, "You know what? You're right. I apologize. Sometimes people want to be held accountable." This one guy was musing to I don't know who, that maybe I was the definition of a cunt. I was married to a Scot for 14 years, so I said, cunt means many different things in different countries. But I'm pretty sure you epitomize the global standard of a dick. I've tried to rise above it. I've tried to get in the trenches, but mostly I would scroll through these social media platforms with one eye partially closed, trying not to see it, but you can't make a cucumber out of a pickle. What is seen goes in. It's traumatic. And I was always secretly hoping in some part of me that what was being said to me and about me wasn't true. Because even I, an avowed, self-declared feminist who worships at the altar of Gloria, internalized the patriarchy. This is really critical. Patriarchy is not boys and men. It is a system in which we all participate, including me. On that particular day, for some reason, that particular tweet after the basketball game triggered something called a cyber mob, this vitriolic, global outpouring of the most heinous hate speech, death threats, rape threats. And don't you know, when I was sitting at home alone in my nightgown, I got a phone call, and it was my beloved former husband, and he said on a voicemail, "Loved one, what is happening to you is not okay." And there was something about him taking a stand for me that night that allowed me to take a stand for myself, and I started to write. I started to write about sharing the fact that I'm a survivor of all forms of sexual abuse, including three rapes, and the hate speech I get in response to that. These are just some of the comments posted to news outlets. Being told I'm a snitch is really fun. Thank you, Jesus. May your grace and mercy shine. So I wrote this feminist op-ed. It is entitled, Forget Your Team. It is your online gender violence toward girls and women that can kiss my righteous ass. And I did that alone, and I published it alone, because my chief advisor said, please don't. The rain of retaliatory garbage that is inevitable, I fear for you. But I trust girls, and I trust women, and I trust our allies. It was published. It went viral. It proves that every single day, online misogyny is a phenomenon endured by us all over the world. And when it is intersectional, it is worse. Sexual orientation, gender identity, race, ethnicity, religion, you name it, it amplifies the violence endured by girls and women, and for our younger girls, it is worse. It's clearly traumatizing. Our mental health, our emotional well-being are so gravely affected because the threat of violence is experienced neurobiologically as violence. The cortisol shoots up, the limbic system gets fired, we lose productivity at work. And let's talk about work. Our ability to work is constrained. Online searches of women applying for jobs reveal nude pictures of them, false allegations they have STDs, their addresses indicating that they are available for sex, with real examples of people showing up at this house for said sex. Our ability to go to school is impaired. 96% of all postings of sexual images in our young people, girls, our girls, our boys, are 2 to 3 times more likely non-consensually to share images. And I want to say a word about revenge porn. Part of what came out of this tweet was my getting connected with allies and other activists who are fighting for a safe and free internet. We started something called the Speech Project, Curbing Abuse, Expanding Freedom. And that website provides a critical forum because there is no global legal thing to help us figure this out. But we do provide on that website a standardized list of definitions because it's hard to attack a behavior in the right way if we're not all sharing a definition of what that behavior is. And I learned that revenge porn is often dangerously misapplied. It is the non-consensual sharing of an image used tactically to shame and humiliate a girl or woman that attempts to pornographize us. Our natural sexuality is, I don't know about yours, pretty gorgeous and wonderful. And my expressing it does not pornography make. So I have all these resources that I'm keenly aware so many people in the world do not. I was able to start the Speech Project with colleagues. I can often get a social media company's attention. I have a wonderful visit to Facebook HQ coming up. Hasn't helped the idiotic reporting standards yet. I actually pay someone to scrub my social media feeds, attempting to spare my brain the daily iterations of the trauma of hate speech. And guess what? I get hate speech for that. Oh, you live in an echo chamber. Well, guess what? Having someone post a photograph of me with my mouth open saying they can't wait to come on my face, I have a right to set that boundary. And this distinction between virtual and real is specious because guess what? That actually happened to me once when I was a child. And so that tweet brought up that trauma and I had to do work on that. But you know what we do? We take all of this hate speech and we disaggregate it and we code it and we give that data so that we understand the intersectionality of it. You know, when I get porn, when it's about political affiliation, when it's about age, when it's about all of it. We're going to win this fight. There are a lot of solutions. Thank goodness. I'm going to offer just a few. And of course, I challenge you to create and contribute your own. Number one, we have to start with digital media literacy. And clearly, it must have a gendered lens. Kids, schools, caregivers, parents, it's essential. Two, shall we talk about our friends in tech? Said with dignity and respect, the sexism in your workplaces must end. Edge, the global standard for gender equality is the minimum standard, and guess what? Silicon Valley, if L'Oreal in India, in the Philippines, in Brazil, and in Russia can do it, you can too. Enough excuses. Only when women have critical mass in every department at your companies, including building platforms from the ground up, will the conversations about priorities and solutions change. And more love for my friends in tech, profiteering off misogyny and video games must end. I'm so tired of hearing you talk to me at cocktail parties, like you did a couple weeks ago in Aspen, about how deplorable hashtag Gamergate was when you're still making billions of dollars off games that maim and dump women for sport. Basta, as the Italians would say. Enough. Our friends in law enforcement have much to do because we've seen that online violence is an extension of in-person violence. In our country, more girls and women have been murdered by their intimate partners than died on 9/11 and have died since in Afghanistan and Iraq combined. And it's not cool to say that, but it is true. We care so much geopolitically about what men are doing over there to women over there. In 2015, 72,828 women used intimate partner violence services in this country. That is not counting the girls and women and boys who needed them. Law enforcement must be empowered with up-to-date internet technology, the devices, and an understanding of these platforms, how they work. The police wanted to be helpful when Amanda Hess called about the death threat she was getting on Twitter, but they couldn't really when they said, "What's Twitter?" Our legislators must write and pass astute legislation that reflects today's technology and our notions of free and hate speech. In New York recently, the law could not be applied to a perpetrator because the crimes must have been committed, even if it was anonymous, they must have been committed by telephone, in mail, by telegraph. The language must be technologically neutral. So apparently, I've got a pretty bold voice. So let's talk about our friends, white men. You have a role to play and a choice to make. You can do something or you can do nothing. We're cool in this room, but when this goes out, everyone will say, "Oh my God, she's a reverse racist."
All right, welcome back to the George Wilder Jr. Show. That was Ashley Judd. Yeah, the actress, of course. You know what? I was earlier, I was saying on the show, CBO numbers, Congressional Budget Office stunner, now saying that 32 million people will be thrown off their health care, would lose care. This is what these guys going to vote on again. Everybody was saying it was dead in the water. It's not dead. Even I was saying it was dead, but it's not dead. As long as the Republicans are in charge of everything, running everything, this Obamacare repeal will always go up for a vote. And it's just sad that so many of these Republicans in Congress are willing to hurt people as if that's part of their job description. To hurt people. These people are just awful. They are just awful. 32 million people, and as of today, after all the wrangling and everybody saying that it's dead for a third time, they're going to bring this thing back up for a vote next week. because Donald Trump chastised them today, got in their butts about not passing it. They can't even go on vacation for it. He can't stop these people from going on vacation. They got to go home and talk to their voters. They got to go home and talk to their constituency. Donald Trump wants to be a dictator. He doesn't give a damn what the people in the district and the communities and the grassroots people want. He knows, he just wants what he wants. You know, he's looking for a win some sort of way, legislatively. He's looking for a win. You know, whatever they put on his desk, he's going to sign it. If 80 million people are going to be thrown off their health care, he's raring to sign it. Remember what he was saying during his campaign? Everybody's going to be covered. Everybody's going to have health care. We're going to repeal and replace Obamacare, but everybody's going to be covered. Liar. Donald Trump conned and lied and BS'd his way into the White House. That is very, very clear to so many of us now. It was clear then, but it is set in stone now. You know, this guy just conned and lied and BS'd his way, clowned his way into the White House. And now even people who are his supporters are saying, maybe this guy has gone too far. Maybe I shouldn't have voted for him, but it's too late. You know what? Even Donald Trump is saying that. Too late, suckers. I got you. You know, the actor Robert De Niro was straight and spot on when he called Donald Trump, before Donald Trump was elected, a clown, a buffoon, a carnival man, or whatever. And he was right. Apparently, Robert De Niro knew him a lot better than we did. I didn't vote for him. Okay, I knew better. But you got people out there who did not know any better. And some of them are actually regretting their vote. This is totally true. Some, not all, some Trump supporters are regretting their vote. But it's too late. Donald Trump is laughing at you. Literally, he's laughing at you. Too late, suckers. I got you. I'm going to cut you off your health care. I'm going to take your food stamps away. You won't be able to see a doctor. We're going to strip Meals on Wheels. We're going to cut out. We're going to cut the senior centers for old people. You know, rich people. Wow. And I'm going to say this again. I just can't understand why people in Congress, rich people, old witch right people, old witch right people want to hurt people. Why? Because they're mean and evil and nasty. Now, that's the reason. I mean, there's no other reason. I'm looking at it right now in Huffington Post saying 32 million people will lose their health care. This is so wrong. This is so wrong on so many continents. This is just totally, totally wrong. And these, you know, 32 million fewer people. All righty. 32 million fewer people would lose health coverage. Health insurance premiums would double. And the insurance market would destabilized over the next 10 years under legislation the Senate may take up next week. They, just like I just got to telling you folks, these people are going to try and pass it next week, even though it may not go anywhere like it didn't go today. It may not go anywhere, but they're going to keep trying it because Trump told them. Not the American people, not the people who put their asses in office, because Trump told them. Trump said it. Trump told him to do it. But Trump has to understand something. Every one of those politicians in Washington, D.C., whether they're a representative or a senator, was sent there by the American people, not by Donald Trump. They represent their constituency. They represent their voters. They don't represent Donald Trump. Now, if you got a lot of these senators, a lot of the people in Congress, like Paul Ryan, you know, licking Trump's boots, and there's a lot of them, then they're not doing their jobs. They never have. They never have. Every congressman, every representative was sent there by a voter, by the voters, not Donald Trump. But yet they're all beckoning to Donald Trump. They're kissing his feet. They're kissing his ass. It's just, and they're screwing their own people. They're screwing the American public by doing this. The majority of Americans can't stand Donald Trump for good reason. Donald Trump, every time he says something, he just blows it out of his ass. And then he says something different and he says something, but the press has to cover it. You know, because he's the president of the United States. You know, I mean, when I say something, I mean, it's not covered all over the world. People are not trying to dissect it to find out the real meaning of what I just said. But Donald Trump is the president of the United States, and they do. And they do. 32 million more will be uninsured under the latest Senate health care bill. It seems like this bill just gets worse and worse and worse for the American public, and the Republicans are raring to pass this bill. Donald Trump is foaming at the mouth to sign it into law. It's just crazy. These people are crazy. That's why I tell people, we have got to vote these people out of office. They have just upended America. This is still a democracy. This is still a free country. But it won't be. It will not be if we don't do something about it. It will not be. This is so wrong on so many levels. It's just... All right, McConnell said he plans to bring up legislation bluntly entitled the Obamacare Repeal Reconciliation Act, which is based on a bill Congress passed in 2015 that then President Barack Obama vetoed last year. They can call it whatever the hell they want to call it. It's going to hurt 32 million, maybe more, American people. He's going to bring it up next week. So we can expect a vote on Obamacare repeal and replace. What they really want to do, they don't want to replace a damn thing. They just want to repeal it outright. They're lying to us. Donald Trump saying, let the bill fail. Now that is stupid. That is so asinine. That is so stupid. Letting the bill fail, letting Obamacare fail, is just like saying let America fail. Donald Trump does not show or know leadership. Letting healthcare fail is unpresidential. Letting it fail. I can't believe I heard those words coming directly out of his mouth. Next week, he didn't say it. Got it all wrong. He didn't say it. His surrogates are going to go around the talk show circuits and say he didn't say it when we heard it come straight out of his mouth. This is the kind of people we have in the White House. This is the kind of people we have in government. And it's going to take us to clean it out, to clean the stank out of Congress, because it's a bunch of it. It's there. It's a lot of it there. And I know November 2018 seems like a million years away, and it does, because we cannot get these guys out, vote them out fast enough. You know, it's going to be a while. And believe me, these guys are trying to scheme already how they're going to get reelected. Because even some diehard Republicans are saying, hey, we're going to be wiped out in November 2018. The American people are going to throw us out on our asses. And he's right. We are going to do that. He's right. I mean, these young senators and these young representatives will be out of a job. See how they like it when they don't have health care. See how they like it. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. Follow me on Facebook. Follow me on Blog Talk Radio. I'm on Twitter. You know, on Twitter, I'm surprised. Twitter, I'm getting a lot of followers on Twitter. You know, I mean, and that's a good thing, I guess. You know, people following me on Twitter. And every day I'm getting somebody wants to follow me on Twitter. You know, I said, great, beautiful. All right, whatever. Anyway, I want to thank Dewey Reynolds, author Dewey Reynolds, for being on the show today. I think he has a great book. His mom and father were criminals. And his book is called Two Shades of Vice. And don't forget yours truly. I have books too. So you check out my stuff too on Amazon. Yeah, the George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air. Hate has no home here. When you are honest and forthright in all things, you never need to worry about covering your tracks or being exposed. So therefore, always be honest and forthright. But that's not going to happen with some people. And a lot of us should never expect that. Some people expect the worst out of people. Sometimes I expect the worst from people and end up getting the best of people. You know, I mean, there's some great people out here, some wonderful people out here, and it's some nasty people out here. So you just have to kind of take the bitter with the sweet, I guess. All right. Be nice to one another out there. It is so easy. It is so easy. On the George Wilder Jr. Show, let's see, Lawrence O'Donnell.
Rachel. Thanks, Lawrence. Well, President Trump lashes out. We all know that. And he has been doing that for a very long time, probably since childhood. He started lashing out at me personally 6 years ago when I called him a liar as soon as he opened his mouth about President Obama's birth certificate. When he became a presidential candidate, he lashed out at Mexicans, at Muslims, and of course, every day at the news media. He has continued lashing out at the news media relentlessly, and he has continued the Trump principle of lashing out at anyone who gets in his way, anyone who causes him a problem. And that tendency to lash out at his opponents has become the cancer on the Trump presidency. That is what I think the cancer on the Trump presidency is. And the president has now taken that to the point where he began today by lashing out at the person who he chose as his deputy attorney general. President Trump nominated Rod Rosenstein to be deputy attorney general, and then the Republican Senate confirmed Rosenstein because the president asked them to confirm him. And today, the president attacked Rod Rosenstein. And so as we approach the...
I'm Keith Olbermann, and this is The Resistance. We have elected an idiot. For all the insanity and the stunning self-absorption and the bullying and the delusional view of America that would embarrass a high school dropout watching cartoons while strung out on meth, the much more existential threat from the Swiss cheese personality of Donald John Trump roared to the forefront over this weekend past. And that existential threat is simply this. In the complex international relations that, like it or not, keep the world from blowing itself up every afternoon, Trump has just proved he has no earthly clue what the fuck he is doing. Just since last Friday, Donald Trump has given aid and comfort to our Russian enemies who are aiming for nothing short of world prominence with the help of their jackass Trump. He has undermined this nation's status as the only enforcer left on the side of human rights. And he has screwed up, whether inadvertently or as reported Sunday night deliberately, nearly four decades of diplomacy, balanced on a razor's edge with China and Taiwan. And just as that China and Taiwan diplomacy began to stabilize, he went and screwed it up again on Twitter. Good work, moron. You don't have to live next door to the United Nations to understand why talking to the president of Taiwan and making it public and referring to the close economic, political, and security ties between Taiwan and the United States just increase the chances that Trump will get some of us, including his supporters, killed. Since 1979, we have played a silly little childish game with mainland China. If we don't make a big deal about that island of Taiwan, if we don't call it a nation, if we recognize that psychologically Taiwan is to the Chinese what communist Cuba has been to us since 1959, if our diplomats and presidents and dipshits elect like Donald Trump don't rub China's nose in it, the Chinese will not wipe the more or less democracy of Taiwan off the freaking map. It's that simple. The 1,350,000,000 mainland Chinese communists will not turn the 23.5 million Chinese on Taiwan into a parking lot. All we have to do is not do exactly what Donald Nitwit Trump did by saying what he did to the Taiwanese president last Friday. But of course, he did it because he thinks he knows better than everybody else about the world when he doesn't know shit. And anyway, what's the fate of 23.5 million Chinese on Taiwan compared to what really matters? The president of Taiwan called me today to wish me congratulations on winning the presidency. Thank you. Interesting how the U.S. sells Taiwan billions of dollars of military equipment, but I should not accept a congratulatory call. Because clearly the point of an incoming presidential administration is to see how many leaders around the world call in to tell him how terrific he is. We now see, 6 weeks out from the inauguration, the outlines of the Trump doctrine. Congratulate Trump! Sunday, a crowded elevator's worth of trumpets pushed a story in the Washington Post that this was all planned. It was a more robust defense of Taiwan, which is, of course, even dumber, especially if the idiot-elect has to publicly disguise his planned robustness as naivete, because, of course, he then gets mad when people call him naive, and so thus he doubles down on the whole thing Sunday night on Twitter. So now not only are the Chinese pissed off, not only is their help in whatever looms next for us in North Korea in jeopardy, and not only is an actual slow growth in the reliability of the relationship between our two countries at risk, but who benefits from uncertainty between the U.S. and China? We don't win from it. The Chinese don't win from it. In whose interest is the new confusion, the new setback, the new ass-hattery from Trump? Russia. Always Russia. Russia. And by the way, guess what flooded out of a WikiLeaks dump Saturday that you probably didn't hear about? 90 gigabytes, 2,420 documents of intelligence related to Germany and the German President Angela Merkel, ahead of Germany's upcoming elections. Germany, which since Trump's election by a minority of our voters has already taken our place as the leading democracy in the world and the only Western power able or willing to stand up against the passive-aggressive world war that Russia has been waging for several years, now with the aid and comfort of President-elect Donald bumbling amateur Putin puppet fucking Trump. And yes, I said Trump's election has already resulted in Germany taking our place as the leading democracy, the leading enforcer on the side of human rights in the world. And if these fiascos with China and Taiwan and WikiLeaks in Germany are not evidence enough, there was a third Trump diplomatic disaster that might actually have eclipsed the other two. Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte, the street thug who has had thousands of his citizens murdered by police and vigilantes without trial, or in many cases without even arrest, on the pretext of an anti-drug campaign. Duterte says he too got on the phone with Trump on Friday, and that Trump endorsed the barbarism Duterte has unleashed. I could sense a good rapport, an animated president-elect Trump, and he was wishing me success in my campaign against the drug problem, Duterte said. He understood the way we are handling it. We are many things in this country, but we have never and must never stoop to murder disguised as law and order by a dictator who has compared his own actions to those of Adolf Hitler as if he were complimenting himself. Worst yet, Duterte said this buffoon Trump has invited him to visit New York and Washington, and bluntly, Rodrigo Duterte should not be admitted to this country even in a casket. But don't tell Trump that. He knows everything. If this is how this dense, pea-brained little man is going to run things. If this is how far in over his own fat orange head he's going to be internationally, if this is how he is going to strut as president, a triple-chinned bull in a nuclear China shop, he cannot be allowed to become president. Because after January 20th, if he decides to have a week of prioritizing receiving congratulations for his inaugural and tweeting out his petulance about Chinese taxes, if he can't manage to keep his fucking ego out of these opaque but essential balancing acts, the ones which stitch together the world as it is, he could get us all killed before his next appointment with whoever or whatever colors his goddamned hair. Resist.
Peace. All right. Thank you, Keith. That was Keith Overman, folks, on the George Wilder Jr. Show. He's, you can tell he doesn't like Donald Trump. Thank you, Keith. That was great. That was beautiful. That was wonderful. And I want to thank my guest, author Dewey Reynolds, for doing the show. His book is Two Shades of Vice. Sounds very compelling. All righty. You've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. It is 7:22 p.m. straight up Chicago time. And it's getting dark. I, you know what I think? I think, folks, I think the days are starting to last a little bit, maybe less, put it that way. I mean, you know, less. It shows, it tells you that winter's coming. Yep, winter is coming. Yeah, I want to get back to this 32 more million people would be uninsured under the latest Senate healthcare bill, in which these guys are going to vote on next week. We all thought it was dead. We all thought it was sitting, it was dead in the water. They failed. They didn't get this thing through. As long as they're in control of Congress, they can vote on this bill every day, every week, if they wanted to, every month. It is never truly dead. Obamacare is never truly dead. These guys are been trying to repeal Obamacare for 7 years. So it's never really dead. Even if they fail on it, if they fail to vote on it, if they fail to get the needed votes they need to pass it and it dies, and it's probably going to die 10 or 20 deaths and more, because they're going to still keep pulling this out of their ass to vote on it because they want to hurt people. They don't want to just repeal Obamacare. They want to hurt people, because the Republicans really don't give a damn about a replacement. They really don't. You know, they want to do what Donald Trump wants them to do. They just want them. Donald Trump wants them to just pass a bill. The hell with a repeal. But the constituency, the American people out here in America, jumping in these politicians' asses and saying, hey, don't do that. And it's working. It's working. I applaud all these people who are out here protesting, rallying, flooding the United States Capitol in Washington, D.C., telling these jerks off at some of these town hall meetings. Those efforts are paying off, and the Republicans know this. Those efforts are paying off big time. But as I've said, as long as the Republicans are in charge, as long as there are Republicans in charge of Congress, and the Republicans constantly, constantly want to throw millions and millions and millions of people off their health care, we have to keep up the fight with these folks. We cannot lay down. We cannot, you know, say to ourselves, hoping other people are going to fight our battles for us. We have to get out there and fight our own battles. We have to fight our own battles. We can't wait for somebody else to fight our battles. Or if you try and wait for other people to fight your own battles, for your battles, for you, then you just may lose your health care. And the Republicans, they are not joking about this. They want to repeal Obamacare, and they don't really want a replacement. They just want to repeal it. They just want to get rid of it, because they've been trying to get rid of it for 7 years. And this is the third time that it's failed, but they're going to bring it up a fourth time. They're going to bring it up a fifth time. They're going to bring it up a sixth time. They want they until they pass it or until it just fails and just fails again. Because this is what these people are, mean, evil, and nasty, and they want to see people die.
Bombs begin to fall. Heaven help the black man if he struggles one more day. Heaven help the white man if he turns back away. Heaven help the man who kicks the man who has a crawl.
George Wilder Jr. Show is just about off the air. I want to thank everybody for tuning into the show and listening and being dedicated listeners to the show. And I appreciate the show is all about you. I mean, you listen to the show and I do value your time because I know time is precious. You don't have to do that. It's a lot of other shows you could be listening to besides mine, but hopefully you're listening. The George Wilder Jr. Show. We have about 5 seconds left on the show. I want to thank everybody for tuning in, and I hope you join me tomorrow. Bye-bye, everybody. Have a great day.